from the current 25,000 with a multi-million dollar plan. The land is rich in water sources. Naftali Bennett said the move has been prompted by the Trump administration's recognition of Israeli sovereignty over the Golan and the Biden administration's indication that it will not soon challenge that decision. Syria has reacted to Israel's decision to expand the number of Jewish settlers in the occupied Golan Heights, calling it a dangerous and unprecedented escalation and a war crime.
Israel continues with its settlement policy and systematic violations, which are war crimes. The Golan Heights is an integral part of Syrian soil, and we will work to return it in full to the homeland by any means permitted by international law.
In the light of the U.S. backing, Israel has also been expanding its settlements in the occupied Palestinian territories, which are illegal under international law. Palestinians believe the U.S. brokered normalization deals between Israel and some Arab states have emboldened the regime to press ahead with its expansionist agenda and land grab policies. But such expansionist policies are just the tip of the iceberg, as acts of violence by Israeli forces and settlers have intensified against Palestinians in the West Bank. That alongside frequent shelling and air raids against the besieged Gaza Strip. The international community has stopped short of taking any practical action in the face of Israel's seizure of Syria's Golan Heights, the occupation of the West Bank, and atrocities against Palestinians as a whole. Israel's aggressive policies will not change the truth that the Golan remains part of Syria, but its fresh expansionist move will create further tensions in a region that has been paying the price of Tel Aviv's destabilization activities.
The United States has approved its biggest defense spending bill in history, allocating $778 billion for the fiscal year 2022. President Joe Biden signed the National Defense Authorization Act into law on Monday following Congress approval. The proposed defense spending is up about 5% compared to the previous year. However, the surprising part of the story is that Congress has allocated about $25 billion more for the military than the Biden administration had requested for. The budget allocates over $740 billion to the Pentagon, while nearly $28 billion would go to the nuclear weapons program. A good portion will be spent on hypersonic weapons and other advanced weaponry, raising the fear of another arms race with Russia. It ensures that the U.S. gives around $3.8 billion to Israel as part of its annual military aid to the regime. But around $7 billion of the hefty defense budget is for what the U.S. calls the Pacific Deterrence Initiative, a plan to strengthen America's presence in the Indo-Pacific region against China. That also means an open call for support for Taiwan, which China regards as its own territory. The budget also envisages $300 million in military aid for Ukraine, which has been a source of tensions between Russia and the U.S.-led Western military alliance, NATO. Many experts believe that Washington's claim of defending Taiwan or Ukraine are just pretexts to make the U.S. military-industrial complex more profitable.
The military industry, military-industrial complex in the States, it really controls the economy. This idea that America's trying to defend Taiwan or Ukraine, these are just pretexts for the profits of the military-industrial complex.
According to data released by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute in April, the massive U.S. military budget was by far the largest in the world in 2021. That was more than the budget of 11 other developed and developing countries combined. That despite the fact that COVID-19 forced many countries, such as South Korea and Russia, to shift part of their planned military spending to pandemic response. Critics argue that the unwarranted increase in defense budget could instead be diverted to address more urgent domestic priorities, such as social injustice or fighting against a pandemic. The critics also say that the budget is more than enough to vaccinate everyone in the world. In July, an anti-war group, Code Pink, warned that the proposed $25 billion hike in the Pentagon budget alone could end homelessness in the United States. The group accused lawmakers of trying to increase the profits of military contractors than meeting the needs of working class. The approved military spending bill also represents a bump from former President Donald Trump's last budget of $740 billion, which was then criticized by Biden's fellow Democrats. Upon entering the White House in January, President Biden had pledged a massive overhaul of U.S. strategy toward the world to make it a better place. However, Biden continues to follow Trump's aggressive and warmongering policies, as the National Defense Authorization Act reflects that billions of dollars will go for the U.S. unending wars across the globe.
Hundreds of people demonstrated in Gaza City in solidarity with female Palestinian prisoners inside Israeli jails. Protesters marched towards the Legislative Council building while shouting slogans against Israel and expressing their unwavering support for the prisoners. In recent weeks, Israeli forces increased their attacks against Palestinian female prisoners. The issue of female Palestinian prisoners is highly emotive to all Palestinians. The protest was organized by the Al-Ahrar movement.
Palestinian female prisoners are being attacked inside Israeli prisons, and we will not remain silent. Attacking female prisoners is an attack on the honor of all Palestinians, Arabs, and Muslims. They were beaten and their ribs were broken by the prison guards. We stand by the prisoners and we will spare no effort to secure their release from Zionist jails.
Palestinians believe that Israel can only be forced into releasing Palestinian inmates under prisoner swap deals. In late 2011, Hamas and the Israeli regime signed a prisoner swap deal under which Israeli soldier Yigal Shalit was released in exchange for over 1,000 Palestinian prisoners.
The Zionist enemy must understand that the issue of Palestinian female prisoners is a red line that must not be crossed at any given time. Attacking and humiliating Palestinian female prisoners will not go unpunished. The Israeli regime will have to face all the consequences of attacking the female prisoners. As we stand here today, we say to all Palestinian prisoners that the resistance factions will always support them and that we will soon liberate them from Zionist jails.
Palestinian prisoners, including females, are kept in 24 Israeli prisons and detention centers and are being subjected to torture and psychological pressures by Israeli prison authorities.
The Zionist regime is trying to commit genocide against Palestinian prisoners amid the silence and normalization of Arab regimes. We call on all Muslims to stand by Palestinian prisoners because Palestinian prisoners are fighting for a just cause. We have also sent a strong warning to the Zionist enemy over the issue of female Palestinian prisoners.
According to legal experts, the Israeli regime has long regarded itself above international laws and norms due to the protection it enjoys from some countries like the United States.
People here are demanding international action to support Palestinian prisoners' struggle for freedom. Israel currently incarcerates some 5,000 Palestinian prisoners, including scores of women and children. Ashraf Shana, Gaza.
With France's presidential election just 4 months away, Europe's largest Muslim community is being scapegoated and targeted by government repression as badly as ever. Almost 100 mosques have recently been raided by the government, with at least two dozen shut down so far. Earlier this year, a so-called anti-separatist law was accused of basically legalizing Islamophobia, as it tried to ban the hijab for minors and force the closure of not just mosques, but highly respected Muslim NGOs such as the Collective Against French Islamophobia. The latest assault on freedom of religion for French Muslims has been sharply criticized by foreign leaders and top NGOs.
France is a republic which claims to be very attached to the idea that the state must be neutral towards all religions. But the past year has seen an incredibly tough interference and meddling in the Muslim community. They're entering mosques and telling religious leaders to say this and to not say that. And this reflects the shift to the extreme right of President Emmanuel Macron's government.
The dominant theme of France's entire presidential election has shifted to the extreme right, as convicted racist Eric Zemmour has provided coronavirus-era France with almost nightly Islamophobic diatribes. Zemmour has rocketed to third place in the polls, giving Macron and other candidates license to blame Muslims for France's economic and political problems.
Zemmour resembles Donald Trump of the United States in that both thrive on outrage, but there are significant differences. Zemmour's entire career has been based around trying to be a part of the political scene and conversation, and he has benefited from support from major parts of the French establishment the entire time.
Il est invité dans tous les plateaux.
Zemmour is invited onto all the television news programs, even though he's a political pyromaniac who is trying to rehabilitate the era of Vichy France, when France collaborated with the German Nazis. He's very dangerous for all of France, and not just France's Muslims, because he's appealing to those who sympathize with the era of French colonial barbarism.
Ever since the Great Recession began, France's political and media elite have stigmatized Muslims to a degree which has gutted the nation's claim to be a global leader in freedom of religion, thought, and speech. The three most popular candidates in the presidential election all seem to be trying to outdo each other in Islamophobia, which has France's Muslims expecting the state-sponsored racism to be even worse over the next 4 months. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en. On Sundays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. In the name of Allah, from whom I hope for nothing but bounty, and from whom I fear nothing but justice. I rely only upon His word, and I cling only to His cord. In Thee I seek sanctuary, O possessor of pardon and good pleasure, from wrong and enmity, and from the changes of time, and the recurrence of sorrows, and from the striking of mishaps, and from the expiration of my term before preparation and readiness. From Thee I seek guidance to that wherein is righteousness and being set right. From Thee I seek help in that which is linked to success and favorable response. Thee I beseech for the garment of well-being and its completion, and for the covering of health and its permanence. I seek refuge in Thee, my Lord, from the goadings of the Satans. And I seek protection in Thy sovereignty from the injustice of the sovereigns. So accept my past prayers and fasting, and make my tomorrow and what is after better than my present hour and my today. And exalt me in my clan and my people, and protect me in my waking and my sleeping. For Thou art Allah, the best guardian, and Thou art the most merciful of the merciful. O Allah, I am quit before Thee on this day of mine and on all Sundays that follow it, of associating others with Thee and of heresy. And I devote my supplication sincerely to Thee, addressing myself to Thy response. And I observe the acts of obedience to You for the hope of Your rewards. So, bless Muhammad, the best of Thy creation, the summoner to Thy truth. Exalt me with Thy exaltation, which is never made to suffer loss. And protect me with Thy eye, which never sleeps, and seal my affair by cutting me off from everything but thee and my life with forgiveness. Surely thou art the all-forgiving, the all-compassionate.
Us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. Palestinian journalists have raised the alarm over what they describe as unjust suppression of their content on Facebook, a claim backed by rights groups. A spokesperson for Facebook's parent company, Meta, has rejected the claim, saying its policies were designed to give everyone a voice, but Palestinian reporters have cited multiple incidents they describe as censorship. Allegations of pro-Israeli bias at Facebook have been simmering for years, and were renewed in October when an international human rights advocate group said the platform had suppressed content posted by Palestinians and their supporters speaking out about human rights violations by Israel. According to a Palestinian social media monitoring center, a record 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were restricted or deleted in 2021 alone. Joining us now from Ramallah is our correspondent, Mona Candia. Mona, how alarming are these findings?
Well, recently it was very clear that journalists and social media activists, when posting anything on Facebook, clearly mentioning the word, let's say, for example, martyr or martyrdom or even Israeli crimes, massacres, that immediately Facebook would remove or delete such posts. Facebook has been removing these posts, claiming they violated the platform's standards. But Palestinians, as you have mentioned, see these claims as a pro-Israeli bias at Facebook, because when it comes to mentioning the Israeli crimes, when it comes to mentioning some issues in the occupied territories, then they would be seen as violating the platform Facebook standards. Palestinians today are saying that Facebook is simply having double standards, is simply backing the Israeli narration. Why it's only the Palestinians who are suffering from these, from especially this treatment. Multiple incidents happened, and they are seen as censorship. According to Palestinian social media monitoring center, Sada Social, said that at least 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were deleted or restricted. We can say that every day a number of Palestinians are being restricted to post anything. It's considered as a punishment just for addressing the Israeli crimes and just for posting some Israeli shootings that are carried out against Palestinians, or even if they write the word martyr in Arabic or martyrdom as well.
All right, thanks a lot, Mona Candy, joining us from Ramallah. Let's now take a look at the tale of the tape of our guest for Spotlight. Founding director of the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies from San Francisco State University, Rabab Abdullah, joining us from San Francisco. Also, we have Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us from Vancouver.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start off with Rabab Abdul Hadi joining us from San Francisco. Allegations of pro-Israeli bias at Facebook have simmered for years. Palestinian reporters have cited multiple incidents they describe as censorship. Is Facebook suppressing freedom of speech?
Yes, definitely there is a lot of evidence of that. The most recent attack has been the big campaign that Palestinian social media bloggers posted, which entitled Facebook Censors Jerusalem. And it was basically where Facebook basically blocked every single post in which Palestinians will, as your reporter said, mention the word martyr, shaheed, a prisoner, Jerusalem. They shut down the two big networks in Jerusalem. They shut down accounts for multiple Palestinians and so on. Facebook claimed that this was about their algorithm. But the question is that the algorithm is designed by people. So who plays these words to make them blocked by algorithm? But I think there is a bigger picture too, that Facebook has historically and continuously continued to block Palestinian content. I can just mention maybe a couple of examples historically by Facebook actually going and making a deal with the Israeli government, Facebook collaborating with the Israeli Ministry of Strategic Affairs, which task is to actually block and silence Palestinian voices and Palestinian advocacy voices for Palestinian liberation around the world. Facebook also, Zuckerberg, met with the Israelis multiple times. They hired as one of the major media people in Facebook a former officer of the Israeli government who is known to be anti-Palestinian. I know from our own experience at the Arab and Muslim Ethnicity and Diaspora Studies program that Facebook has been targeted by several pro-Zionist groups that have tried to shut us down, starting in 2013 with the Simon Wiesenthal Center, which is in Los Angeles, which has been built, the so-called Museum of Tolerance, on the land of the Palestinian cemetery, Ma'manillah, Mamila, in Jerusalem. It was followed by my provost, my own academic provost, demanding that I take down a post in which I criticize my university president for welcoming Zionists to campus, which is supposed to be my own academic freedom. And the post that I posted was actually, I shared the post from one of our student groups, Jews Against Zionism, who said that they are opposed to welcoming Zionism on campus because of its colonialism, its racism, its apartheid. And it had a picture of a young student who was saying, I'm not anti-Zionist, I'm anti-Zionist, I'm not anti-Semitic, free Palestine. And so they thought that this was actually a violation. The university provost demanded that I take it down. The dean demanded that I take it down. And I said, no, I'm not going to be doing it. This is my academic freedom, as was condemned by the university president and the chancellor. But then afterwards, also last year, Facebook shut down our page completely, took down years of archives, of online classes, of syllabi, of material, of everything else. They are not explaining why they have done
that. Let's bring in Charlotte Cates on the discussion as well. Ms. Cates, similar calls were renewed in October when an international human rights advocate group said that Facebook had suppressed content posted by Palestinians and their supporters speaking out about human rights issues speaking about human rights violations carried out by Israelis. So the claim is not just coming from Palestinian sources. Why is this happening, in your opinion? Why is information pointing out Israeli human rights violations and crimes, are they being suppressed and concealed?
Well, when we look at the role of these big tech companies, so we've got Facebook, Twitter, Zoom, these kinds of big tech companies, they are engaged in shaping a narrative that works hand in hand with U.S. imperialism. These are some of the largest corporations that are currently based in the United States. And so we're seeing that being weaponized against Palestinian discourse, the censorship of words like martyrs, the censorship of the names of Palestinian political parties and organizations, in order to serve the interests, frankly, of U.S. imperialism and its alliance with the Israeli occupation. We see the same thing taking place in which content from countries targeted by sanctions and U.S. imperialism is labeled as state-sponsored content, while the same kind of content from official sources, for example, from the BBC or a German-sponsored media agency, are not labeled as state-sponsored content. And so this is an attack by big tech to control the access of to information that people have around the world because of the fact that Palestinians have been so successful in breaking the silence imposed upon the Palestinian cause by mainstream media and corporate media and imperialist states through their creative and active use of social media, technology, and various methods of communication.
Sure. Ms. Abdulhadi, an account of a Palestinian journalist was restricted twice this year, once just in December when videos depicting Israeli attacks on Palestinians were posted. In both cases, Facebook said it intervened because the posts violated the platform's standards. A spokesperson for Facebook's parent company, Meta, said that its policies were designed to give everyone a voice while keeping them safe on our apps, also adding, quote, "We apply these policies to everyone equally, regardless of who is posting." Is that the case?
Actually, that's definitely not the case. And there is so many flaws in this argument. One is that when they say they are applying equally, who is applying equally? And who's really setting the standards? And according to whom? And who's participating in it? We know there are high officials in Facebook who are setting it thus in consultation with various governments. They have done it again and again and again. So it's actually the whole question of equal is really not true, and it's an inaccurate labeling to start with. Secondly, the whole question of how they are setting up is also a question. Third is that why is it that Facebook is also shutting down, as my colleague Charlotte Cates said, shutting down posts also from, for example, on Kashmir liberation. They're shutting down posts on any other liberation around the world and actually allowing a lot of weaponizing of hate speech, of violence, of incitement to be there and succumbing to the pressures from various Israeli groups and various hate groups, various racist groups and so on. And it has to do with the fact that we're dealing with the Silicon Valley and we're dealing with Facebook as well as Zoom and other platforms which are very much profit-related, and they are only concerned with their alliances and they're not really concerned with the truth and justice. They are only concerned with actually adding more ads and getting more people to subscribe. And so they believe that if they are suppressing Palestine, that might actually work. The problem with that is that it will always backfire because there is more and more people supporting Palestine. There is more and more people recognizing what's going on. Major human rights violation, major human rights organizations have already documented and stated what has happened. Major electronic groups such as the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others have also documented what has been going on. So Facebook is actually really stuck now having to explain what is going on. So they're backpedaling to cover up the wrong that they are doing by aligning themselves with Israel and its racist and colonialist policies,
right,
and by suppressing Palestinian voices.
Right. Charlotte Cates, do you recall the issue? I think it was from earlier this year when young teenage girls were being targeted by sexual predators on Facebook. We spoke to a staff member right here on our channel from the company who alluded to lax protocols for monitoring content on Facebook. So let's hit pause there and come back to the issue that we're talking about right now regarding Palestinian posts. A Meta spokesperson said that it has a, quote, dedicated team which includes Arabic and Hebrew speakers who are focused on keeping our community safe by making sure we're removing harmful content. So which is it? They have a team of watchful eyes for pro-Palestinian content, but the pedophiles aren't as harmful?
Well, it's sad. If we look at May of this year, May of 2021, during the Unity Uprising throughout occupied Palestine, Facebook was seemingly a very safe place for hateful content by Zionist extremists encouraging violence in occupied Palestine 48 and participating in the ongoing riots targeting Palestinians in Palestine 48, assistance of the Israeli occupation army. And we've seen that systematically in hateful, racist, openly, blatantly racist content posted in sources is deemed to be acceptable, while merely listing the name of a Palestinian political party like Hamas, Islamic Jihad, or the Popular Front for Palestine in a news article makes that same information dangerous by Facebook. And so what we see is that these big tech companies bring out the narrative of the Israeli occupation and of U.S. imperialism Palestinian content. So it's also quite a safe space for forms of racist hatred, white supremacy, Zionist for Palestinian content and for internationalist content imperialism. There's no concern for the community safety of Palestinians by Zionists. There's no concern for the community safety of Palestinians living under the bombs in Gaza, in exile around the world, or in being targeted by the guns of the occupier in the West Bank and Jerusalem or Palestine 48. Palestinian safety is considered to be something that is not the responsibility of Facebook, just like the Israeli mutual approach that's taken with the Israeli occupation. In same way, we've seen time and time again that there are actually thousands and tens of thousands of reports filed by the Israeli occupation regime with Facebook on a regular basis. And we saw in 2015 during the Al-Quds uprising that was taking place that Israeli occupation essentially put strong pressure on Facebook and threatened to ban it within the country. And while Facebook was already a big tech company kind of serving U.S. interests, after 2015, we saw a dramatic escalation in the number of Palestinian posts being taken down and targeted because of this ongoing coordination that was established between Facebook and the Israeli occupation state.
Okay, Ms. Abdul-Hadi, according to Palestinian Social Media Monitoring Center, Sada Social, a record 600 Palestinian accounts or pro-Palestinian Facebook posts were restricted or deleted in 2021. We said that's a record for the year. So the Palestinians, basically, they face an asymmetrical battle both on the ground and also in the media. What alternatives does that leave for the Palestinians? I think that's where many observers and commentators come in and say that resistance is the only alternative for Palestinians at this point.
Yes, of course. Palestinians, I should just say that, have been resisting for over 100 years the Zionist settler colonialism in Palestine. The resistance is not new. It continues and it keeps escalating and it keeps including more and more people. And every single time Israel succeeds in crushing a major defeat by conducting massacres, by killing hundreds of people and so on, that has happened multiple times around Gaza. That is happening sometimes silently, not even reported in the media, in Jerusalem, Sheikh Jarrah, in Silwan, in the Old City, in Lib, in Akka, in Haifa, in Bir Sabah, in Naqab. This is happening all the time. And I think biggest part of the problem for Israel and its supporters, including Facebook, is that they have been unable to crush Palestinian resistance. They have been unable to say that this is a land without people for a people without a land. They failed. Israel has failed. Zionism has failed to do so. So they are escalating their aggression and their attempt to silencing and crush using the money accounts that they have with the pressures of the Facebook and Silicon Valley and so on. They're using the pressures with the Israeli Ministry of the Ministry of Strategic Affairs. For example, there is this app called ActIL that sent 19,000 messages to Zoom to shut down an open classroom that my colleague Tomomi Kanekawa and I were organizing last year with the Palestinian feminist icon Leila Khaled. They continue doing this again and again. Sada Social is totally 100% correct in what is going on. So this means that, of course, Palestinians will continue resisting. They have no choice but to resist. A people that is suppressed is always going to yearn to be free. It will resist, It will continue to resist by every single aspect available to them, including the many Palestinian social media activists who are raising the voices high and making it known to us that there is censorship that is going on. Otherwise, we wouldn't know. People who are not in the inside Palestine and so on would not know what's going on. And the fact that the world is responding, the world is responding, the world is condemning what Israel is doing. We would like the world to be a little bit faster in that, so less Palestinian lives and less lives all around are being lost. But the Palestinians have no choice. They have to resist, and they will continue on resisting until all Palestine is free.
Right. Charlotte, Kate, one angle of all of this is trying to align anti-Zionism with anti-Semitism. For example, if you criticize Israel, then you're being an anti-Semite. But we know that many Jews, even Israeli Jews, that criticize Israel for its rights violations and crimes. Is this just another way of trying to control the narrative, in your opinion?
This is another example of the attempt to turn reality on its head. The reality is that the Palestinian Liberation Movement is an anti-fascist, anti-colonial movement that is on the side of all people who are fighting against racism, oppression, and discrimination and all. On the other hand, the Zionist movement is fundamentally a fascist that is based on racism, colonialism, and so by invoking the concept of when really Zionism is itself an anti-Semitic, the concept of anti-Semitism or anti-Jewish prejudice, the leaders of Israeli war crimes and Israeli apartheid are attempting to change the discourse to focus instead on the idea that Palestinian colonialism and fighting back to defend their rights are somehow the oppressors in the nation. It's an attempt to turn reality on its head. In reality, if we want to, anti-Jewish oppression, anti-Semitism, just like all forms of racism, this means standing hand in hand with the Palestinian liberation struggle, not hand in hand with the Zionist movement, which has increasingly built its ties with every far-right and fascist regime around the world, regardless of their position on the crimes of the Nazis, regardless of their position on fascism. That's who the Israeli state is aligned with, okay. Is the far right, is the fascist forces.
Well, let's get a final thought in from Ms. Abdul Hadi. I'd like to get your thoughts on the same issue. Is all of this happening to control the narrative, making the previous statement that we just mentioned some kind of default, that if you're anti-Israeli, then you're an anti-Semite and you must be shunned and banned and silenced?
Yes. I will just say three points about this in addition to what we've already heard from your guest, Charlotte Gates. One is that, yes, they are trying to control the narrative. The Palestinian narrative is a narrative of resistance, of resilience, of steadfastness. Zionism is trying to impose a narrative of submission, subjugation, and defeat, and they are, of course, trying to do that. This is failing. This is something that actually is going on. That's one thing that's really, really important. Secondly, what does this really mean? It means that for all of us not to be silent, for all of us to say we will not be silenced, we're actually going to escalate and raise every single voice of Palestine high and amplify the Palestinian demands to be able to speak, to be able to express, to be able to reflect the reality on the ground to the outside world. The final point I would say is that there is so many more support for Palestine all over. Zionism claiming that that anti-Zionism is anti-Semitism is failing also among multiple and broader ranks of Jews, not to mention other people around the world who are seeking justice. At the end of the day, Zionism has really failed, but that's why also bullies become bullier, become more vicious whenever they are
sure.
failing. The only solution is for us to continue resisting, raising our voices, speaking up, and saying we will not be silenced.
Indeed, and that's all the time we have for tonight's show. Allow me to thank my guests, founding director at the Arab and Muslim Ethnicities and Diaspora Studies at San Francisco State University, Rabab Abdul Hadi, joining us from San Francisco, and also thanks to Ms. Charlotte Cates from the Samadun Palestinian Prisoner Solidarity Network, joining us from Vancouver. And thanks to you for staying with us on Big Spotlight. It's good night for now.
bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Recently, the Commonwealth of Independent States commemorated 30 years of its existence in St. Petersburg, Russia, and highlighted a united front against NATO's eastward strides. We're prepared for you an article written by Dr. Swaram Singh, Professor of Diplomacy and Disarmament at the School of International Studies, Jawaharlal Nehru University in New Delhi, India. The piece is titled, At the Commonwealth of Independent States, Putin Champions Solidarity Amid Ukraine Crisis. Tuesday, 28th of December, the Commonwealth of Independent States commemorated 30 years of its existence. In December of 1991, this informal arrangement among the majority of former Soviet republics declared the end of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, or USSR, also ending the Cold War in international politics. And now, in the midst of the ongoing COVID-19 pandemic and the Russo-Ukrainian crisis, this informal summit in St. Petersburg, attended in person by all 9 national leaders, has radiated goals and implications way beyond their limited to-do list. Fundamentally, the summit showcased former Soviet Republic's solidarity with Russian President Vladimir Putin, who faces a purportedly united West seeking Ukraine's co-option into NATO's further eastward strides. However, Ukraine was not even mentioned in this year-end get-together of CIS leaders who reviewed the results of Belarus's chairmanship of the Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, in 2021 and discussed future plans of their cooperation. Commemorating these past 30 years, President Vladimir Putin credited the Commonwealth of Independent States members for having preserved their deeper security and economic cooperation, and for helping them getting through these difficult times of the pandemic. Putin said, "We have witnessed monumental shifts over the past years. At the same time, we have been deepening our integration, lingering positive impact from the ties we have been sharing since the Soviet era." Focusing on the agenda at hand, Vladimir Putin said, "One of the main topics that brought us together is our common efforts to counter the coronavirus pandemic," whereupon he called on his special invitee, Russia's chief sanitary physician, Anna Popova, who has been coordinating Russia's response to COVID-19 with its Commonwealth of Independent States counterparts, to brief the leaders on work done so far, as well as plans for the future, including signing of an agreement on cooperation in response to and relief from sanitary and epidemiological emergencies. No doubt this allowed Russia to showcase its leading role in providing pandemic relief to the CIS states. But President Putin's hosting it in person, and the several bilateral meetings he held also carried a message for all, including American interlocutors for the upcoming meeting in Geneva, Switzerland, on 10th of January, where Moscow wishes to push forward on ways to halt the North Atlantic Treaty Organization's eastward expansion and end its military cooperation with countries such as Ukraine and Georgia. It was in 1922 that the treaty and declaration of the creation of the USSR was first signed by Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. Fast forward to 8th of December 1991, and the same three countries signed the agreement establishing the Commonwealth of Independent States, thus replacing the USSR and inviting other Soviet republics to join. Eight other republics joined them at their next meeting in Alma-Ata, now Almaty, in Kazakhstan, on 21st of December 1991, when they all signed a protocol declaring Russia as a successor state of the USSR, and marking this as the foundation day of the Commonwealth of Independent States, or CIS. Georgia joined the CIS later in 2004, but after it joined NATO, which led to tensions with Moscow and the Russo-Georgian War, it withdrew from the Commonwealth of Independent States in 2009. Likewise, the three Baltic republics, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, which considered their integration into Soviet Union an illegal occupation, never joined the Commonwealth of Independent States. They instead joined NATO. Likewise, Bulgaria, Romania, Slovakia, and Slovenia, formerly part of the Eastern Bloc, though not actual Soviet republics, also joined NATO, igniting serious insecurities in Moscow. Ukraine, the second most powerful state of the USSR, had always been the most curious and yet confusing part of the Commonwealth of Independent States story. Ukraine signed the first two agreements and protocols of December of 1991, but never ratified the January 1993 Charter of the Commonwealth of Independent States. Nevertheless, Ukraine was treated as a founding member of the CIS until Article 7 of that charter, which defined the signatories of those first two meetings at the Commonwealth's founding members. Moreover, in 1994, Ukraine joined the Commonwealth of Independent States Economic Union as an associate member. So Russia always insisted that Ukraine was a member of the Commonwealth of Independent States, and therefore the CIS Secretariat continued to send it invitations for all the meetings. But for its part, Ukraine had a very different understanding on the role and remit of the Commonwealth of Independent States, and rarely participated in Commonwealth of Independent States parleys and programs. Indeed, on 18th of May 2013, then-President Petro Poroshenko signed a decree on Ukraine's official termination of its participation in the CIS. From 2014 onwards, Ukraine gradually distanced itself from the Commonwealth of Independent States, CIS, exiting various statutory bodies, not paying its contributions to the budget, and over time abandoning more than 50 agreements, memoranda, and decisions. Finally, in August of 2018, it not only stopped participating in CIS activities, but shut down its representative offices at the Commonwealth of Independent States headquarters in Minsk, Belarus. In the post-Soviet context, other than their contestations about the sharing of the Soviet debts and assets, status of the Russian language in Ukraine, ownership of the Soviet-era Black Sea Fleet and its Sevastopol naval base, and the related question of Crimea, Ukraine and Russia had serious differences on the role and functioning of the Commonwealth of Independent States. This briefly created serious misunderstandings among several Commonwealth of Independent States members, impacting its work and stature. Against this backdrop, in 1997, Russia signed a treaty of friendship, cooperation, and partnership with Ukraine, recognizing its borders. But the current phase of their conflict is often connected to the NATO's indulgences with Ukraine and reignited their differences. Their conflict was to become public during the presidential elections of 2004, when the so-called Orange Revolution prevented Viktor Yanukovych from coming to power and pro-West Viktor Yushchenko became the president of Ukraine. Also in 2008, U.S. President at the time George W. Bush pushed for inclusion of Ukraine into NATO. European nations managed to forestall his plan with no timelines finalized, but it triggered a process of NATO's penetration into Ukraine, emboldening Kiev to withstand Vladimir Putin's strategies, where he was seen as contemplating a reunification of Russia, Belarus, and Ukraine. Internally as well, these interfering U.S. policies triggered countrywide unrest in Ukraine, leading to Viktor Yanukovych's fleeing to Russia in February of 2014. In a referendum by the people of Crimea in March of 2014, this region merged with Russia. This encouraged Russian-speaking minorities in the Donbas region of eastern Ukraine to rise against the government in Kiev and declare the creation of new People's Republics of Donetsk and Luhansk. These crises were resolved in the Minsk Agreement of March 2015, which stands at the very center of their escalating brinkmanship. Under that pact, Ukraine agreed to consider these quasi-republics' demand for autonomy. However, the nationalist forces at home and NATO's allurements from the West saw Kiev retreating from implementing the agreement, and an impasse has remained since the December 2019 Russia-Ukraine talks in Paris, France. This period has also seen President Volodymyr Zelensky of Ukraine incrementally rebuilding partnerships with NATO, leading to Russia's current heavy forward deployments. This is where it comes pertinent to understand the role of the Russia-led Commonwealth of nine former Soviet republics. President Putin is fully aware of the cautious approach of several European NATO member states that will be dependent on Russian gas to revive their post-pandemic economies. This explains why Vladimir Putin wants to expand the dialogue beyond U.S. President Joe Biden's domestically driven arbitration on the Ukraine crisis. Vladimir Putin's recent summits with India and China also show that there are other potential customers for Russia's energy supplies. Indeed, Ukraine itself wants to negotiate with Russia for extension of latter's gas transit beyond 31st of December 2024, when the current agreement expires. Yet Russia remains reluctant, saying it will depend on its own supply contracts and on target recipients' whims and fancies. So, have Vladimir Putin's summits with India, China, and now the Commonwealth of Independent States revealed the boomerang effect of a united West posturing a tough line? And is it possible that Ukraine, having burnt its bridges with Russia, regrets its own absence from recent Commonwealth of Independent States summit?
Good morning. heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.